Okay, I think we're good to go. Apologies for the delay, but let's get cracking, hey? My name's Paul Dreesen. I'm an actuary at Taylor Fry, and it's my pleasure today to chair the first concurrent session, which is looking at considerations in moving from a third-party fault-based scheme to a first-party no-fault scheme. And we're going to hear from Vivian C, Mary Tang and Peter McCarthy from Ernst & Young. Now, Mary Tang is a manager in EY's actuarial services practice and has over 6 years of experience in the Australian general market in a variety of lines of business. Vivian C is an associate director in EY's actuarial services practice and has 11 years of experience in general insurance consulting. Vivian has experience with workers' comp, CTP, product and public liability, medical indemnity, from a variety of perspectives, including schemes, insurers and self-insurers. Peter McCarthy is a partner in the financial services group of EY and has over 28 years' experience in the personal injury schemes. He spent 9 years working in large general insurers, which included management of large personal injury portfolios. He has advised a wide variety of clients, including governments, insurers, self-insurers, reinsurers and corporates on personal injury matters. Peter has a long involvement with claims management, especially personal injury claims, and has led a number of claims leakage studies for government schemes and insurers and subsequent claims transformations. He has seen firsthand how important claims management is to the successful management of a personal injury scheme. Peter has been involved in a number of accident scheme reviews, both from the insurer perspective and also as an advisor to governments, most recently the actuary's advisor to the New South Wales Government on their CTP reforms. And he is currently convener of the Institute of Actuaries General Insurance Practice Committee. Over the last 2 years, Peter, Vivian and Mary have been heavily involved in the New South Wales CTP reform process, assisting the Motor Accidents Authority in investigating scheme design options, including benefit changes, claims process, premium system, the bill and stakeholder communications. Can you please welcome EY?
Thank you, Paul. Today we're going to share some of our learnings from different stakeholder perspectives in moving from a third-party fault-based scheme to a first-party no-fault-based scheme. What we hope you to get out of from today's presentations are that in moving to a first-party no-fault scheme, there are many aspects that require detailed considerations, and many of those aspects are actually interlinked. Therefore, if you make one changes to one aspect, there can be unintended consequences to another aspect. Yes, it does mean that the process may not be easy. Today, we're going to present some of the options to assist with such a move. There are policy and social advantages in a first-party no-fault scheme. We acknowledge that it's not a perfect system, yet no scheme is perfect. But given these advantages, it's worth investigating the move to a first-party no-fault scheme. Another thing that we would like to highlight is that many of the considerations and options presented today are in the context of a privately underwritten scheme. Before we start, let's clarify on some of the terminologies that we've used so far, as they are not mutually exclusive. One set of terms that we've introduced are at fault versus no fault. At fault means that only the not at fault parties are covered, and no fault means that both at fault and not at fault parties are covered. Another set of terms that we've introduced are third party versus first party. Third party means that the claims are managed and lodged with the insurer of the most at fault vehicle. While in the first party scheme, claims are made and managed by the insurer of the vehicle in which the injured party was travelling in. Generally, first party is aligned with no fault and third party is aligned with fault based. Don't confuse first party versus third party with common law versus defined benefits. because it is possible to have both defined benefits and common law benefits in both first party and third party schemes. So why are we here today? Why no fault? There are various studies, including the 2011 Productivity Commission report, that have found that no-fault schemes are generally more superior to at-fault-based schemes. Some of the advantages include, one, no-fault schemes provide more consistent coverage to injured parties. The benefits are accessible by all parties, regardless of fault or the cause of the injury. Secondly, no-fault provides more predictable benefits. Defined benefits are normally more aligned in a no-fault-based scheme. Therefore, the injured party knows upfront exactly what they are entitled to and don't have to rely on cost systems. Thirdly, no-fault focuses more on recovery outcomes by reducing reliance on the adversarial system. Fault-based schemes could reduce the scope to improve health outcomes because the greater the recovery, the less likely, or I guess the lower the potential of level of compensations that we'll likely get. And fourthly, no fault is likely to be more efficient or less costly because there are less transaction costs or friction costs. Last but not least, a no-fault scheme is not worse than a fault-based scheme at preventing risky behaviours. Although no-fault schemes sometimes are seen as not punishing the at-fault parties who caused the injury. However, it is found that there's no clear evidence that common law can achieve the same, as at the end of the day, it is the insurer who end up paying. Given the advantages of a no-fault scheme, we expect there will be greater consideration of them over time. In fact, the Australian and New Zealand workers' compensation schemes are already no fault. The NDIS and the NIS schemes have been set up under these principles. The chart here shows that the current state of play for the CTP schemes in Australia and in New Zealand. Some Australian and New Zealand CTP schemes are already no fault, like Northern Territory. And some Australian CTP schemes have investigated implementing a no fault scheme, such as South Australia. But the extent of the no fault does vary by each state, and with a hybrid arrangement in New South Wales. An example of a defined benefit, no fault, privately underwritten scheme overseas is the New York no-fault auto insurance scheme. Many of the considerations and options discussed today are in the context of a privately underwritten scheme. We acknowledge that no system is perfect. We are not advocating for or against a privately underwritten scheme. So in a privately underwritten scheme, some of the challenges that we have observed include, one, fault determination may still be required if it is decided that common law benefits are allowed in the scheme, or it is decided that an at-fault party should bear some of the ultimate costs. This will have flow-on impact to premium setting. The risk profile in a no-fault scheme is very different to the risk profile of a at-fault scheme. Costs attributed to at-fault drivers and single vehicle accidents are now included in the no-fault schemes, which were not included in the at-fault-based scheme. As a result, there might be changes to risk rating factors that are used for setting premium. However, the extent of the changes depend on how much the scheme wants to be placed on the continuum of pure risk rating versus community rating. And if the premium system is not allowed or is prevented from recognising this change, then there will be further cross subsidies in the premium system, and this could affect market dynamics and discourages competition. There are various interactions in an insurance context. We will examine these interactions over the remaining slides. Firstly, we'll look at the interaction between the customer and the insurer after an accident has occurred. Then, we'll look at the interactions between the insurers in determining liability and the considerations in setting premium in a first-party no-fault scheme. The claimant experience with the insurer is very different under a third-party scheme and under a first-party scheme. If two cars collided in a third-party scheme, firstly, fault needs to be determined, and the at-fault driver's third-party insurer will manage the claims of all injured parties. And the injured party in the not-at-fault vehicle does not get to choose who to manage their claim. And the at-fault driver may have chosen that managing insurer because they were the cheapest and not necessarily the one that provides the best service. Also, there is limited incentives for the managing insurer to increase service quality because there is no direct relationship with, some of the injured parties, especially the not at fault, as they are not their policyholders. And in a third-party scheme, there is a risk of delay in providing appropriate treatment because liability still need to be determined and debated. The claimant experience with the insurer is very different under a first-party scheme. Firstly, the policyholders or the claimant know exactly who they're dealing with, that is, their chosen CTP insurer. It is in the insurer's interest to manage that relationship well, to provide the best quality and provide the appropriate treatment as soon as possible, as this can have impact on the policyholder's renewal decision. The relationship between the claimant and the insurer can be further complicated in a first-party no-fault scheme, depending on the type of benefits that are available. Although defined benefits are generally more aligned to a no-fault scheme, it is possible to have common law access. In this presentation, we are not advocating for or against the extent of common law access. The diagram here illustrates, some of the implications with common law benefits in a first-party, no-fault, privately underwritten market or scheme. For defined benefits, it is clear that the injured party will lodge a claim with their direct insurer in a first-party scheme. But for common law benefits, who should the injured party lodge the claim with? Who should manage the claim? Who should be liable for the claim? The diagram here shows a number of options. One, the injured party can lodge a separate claim with the insurer of the at-fault party, or the insurer of the injured party can sue the at-fault party on the injured party. Can sue the at-fault driver on the injured party's behalf, hence involving the insurer of the at-fault party as well. Or should the legislation deem the insurer to be the only insurers liable for the cost in order to facilitate common law settlement? If it is decided that two insurers will manage the defined benefits and the common law benefits separately, then it is possible for one insurer's cost to affect another insurer's cost, because often common law benefits depend on the amount that has already been paid in defined benefits. And this implies that sometimes another insurer's balance sheet can be managed by another insurer's another insurer's actions.
So, can you hear me?
Yeah, okay, sorry. So now that we've talked about the claimants in a relationship with the insurer, now the insurer now has the claim, what happens to the cost of that claim? So let's say in an example we have two vehicles in an accident. The family of five in the not-at-fault vehicle all suffer injuries as a result of the angry driver sitting in the at-fault vehicle. Under a third-party scheme, the insurer of the not-at-fault vehicle would receive zero claims, whereas the insurer of the at-fault vehicle would manage the claims of the family of five, as well as possibly the at-fault driver if the driver is eligible for benefits under the scheme. In contrast, under a first-party scheme, the insurer of the not-at-fault vehicle would manage all five claims from the family of five, whereas the at-fault insurer would then only manage the one claim from the at-fault driver if that driver is entitled to benefits. So in changing from a first party to a third party, there is a sudden shift in the cost of claims managed by each insurer. The question is, in a privately underwritten scheme, should the not-at-fault insurer bear the cost? And if so, that would ultimately flow on into the costs for the at-fault policyholder. And the question is whether that's desirable to do so from a social policy perspective. Nevertheless, this raises the possibility that you can split up the management of the claims from the liability of the claim. So, who bears the cost and what are the options? There is actually a continuum of options, and it's not necessarily a two-dimensional continuum. It ranges from not sharing at all to having the cost all allocated to the most at-fault vehicle, or you can share costs as evenly as possible between all the insurers. So in a privately underwritten market, the decision about where you sit on the continuum is very important because it ultimately affects the how insurers price and pass on costs to policyholders. Looking at the options in more detail, at one extreme where we have the insurer bearing all costs of the claims that they manage, one advantage is that obviously no-fault determination is required. This option also gives insurers the most incentive to manage the claims as efficiently and as effectively as possible because the financial consequences of it is borne by the managing insurer. However, in this particular model, though, it would obviously shift the balance of premium between various policyholders quite significantly to the current at-fault model. At the other end of the spectrum, where we have costs borne by the most at-fault party, fault determination is obviously required. But the issue is that there could be a significant number of disputes as insurers all avoid trying to be the one left holding the bag at the end to avoid minimising the cost. So friction costs under that model can be quite significant. The other extreme, where we have costs shared equally amongst all insurers, whilst this is a physically quite a simple approach, one of the problems with that is that it might share the risks amongst the insurers a little bit too much, or it might smooth the risks too much, and that gives insurers less incentive to competitively price risk and find segments of the market that they think that they can price better than competitors. So from a competition perspective, it may not be the best option. Then there's obviously other shades in between where you can have costs shared in proportion to fault. Ideally, that might be, you know, a nice way of doing things, but obviously it's quite hard to objectively measure fault, so that becomes quite difficult. And then we've got another shade of grey where you can split up the costs of not-at-fault claims and share them in a different way to at-fault claims and maybe share or not share those costs. So in disconnecting the management of the claim with the cost of the claim, it can have a lot of bearing on insurer behaviours. Naturally, insurers will want to have greater control over the costs and the costs that they're liable for. And conversely, insurers would want as little as possible of the costs that they're liable for being managed by competitors. So ultimately, the decision about where you sit on that continuum depends heavily on how you weigh the pros and cons from the perspective of claimants and policyholders. And from claimants, you may consider things about, you know, which option provides the better claimant experience, better claim, better health outcomes. From an insurer perspective, you obviously want to think about which option gives you the greatest ability to price risks appropriately, and also selecting an option that promotes the most amount of competition, efficiency, less friction costs in the market. And obviously from a regulator point of view, you want a system that's sustainable in the sense that premiums remain affordable and a system where the insurers want to remain within the market. So overall, it means that sharing is a necessary part of a privately underwritten scheme, but balancing between what is too little sharing and too much sharing is something that requires a lot more consideration. So on to premiums and pricing. So before you get into the detail of how do you set up the premium system or how you might change a premium system, one of the things that's very important is setting up sort of the goalposts about what is your scheme philosophy or what is the social policy, what are the aims of your social policy. And that might be defining about what you think, what is affordable in terms of premium, what is the maximum kind of, what is the maximum level of premium you expect your policyholders to pay. And another thing about where you want to sit in terms of between community rating and pure risk rating, where do you want to sit in that continuum? Do you want one price for all for everyone, or do you want a price that reflects a little bit of the risks borne by the policy, the risks of the policyholder? And another thing is that when you go to a user pay system, the question is, under a first party scheme, should it reflect who receives the benefits, or should it reflect who causes an accident that results in these claims being paid? So there's a lot of questions in that area. There's another thing about the premium system we found is that you can split it into two parts. One is being, we call it sort of the front end, and that's the bit that the policyholder sees, and that's the bit that is the premium that the consumer sees or is charged in their policy. But then there's also this back-end approach where we, that's sort of where we lump all the adjustment transactions that can take place between insurers to help with the to manage the cross-subsidisation to a level that is desired within the scheme. And that might be things around sharing that we've talked about, and it can also be things like risk pooling that I'm going to get to in the next few slides. But coming back to risk drivers and risk rating for a moment, let's assume that the preferred philosophy is that premium should reflect risk to some extent. And there can be a significant change in terms of the risk factors considered in a third party scheme, a third party at fault scheme, to a first party no fault scheme. For schemes that use premium relativities, the change can be quite significant because the inclusion of things like the claims of single vehicle accidents can have significant impact on segments like country drivers and motorcyclists. For trucks, if we work on the premise that trucks tend to be is less likely to be the party at fault, and they also suffer less severe injuries than parties travelling in the smaller vehicle involved in an accident with a truck, then in incorporating the at-fault driver cost of that smaller vehicle, that's going to shift the proportion of costs. If you look at the totality of costs, that's going to shift the cost towards the smaller vehicle by including the at-fault driver claims. So again, in doing that, that can also change the relativity for trucks in making it lower. And for buses, obviously, in a no-fault situation where the bus is carrying a lot of passengers, that obviously has huge implications for the CTP pricing for buses. In schemes where insurers are able to risk rate beyond the premium relativities, there needs to be a rethink of what allowable rating factors might be, what rating factors may be allowable in such a scheme, in the first-party no-fault scheme. So obviously, the more passengers you have in a vehicle, the more exposed you are to a claim in an event of an accident. In a third party scheme, your insurer cannot predict what vehicles you run into. So they can't price for that risk of how many passengers in a vehicle that you're likely to hit. Whereas in a first party scheme though, your insurer can price for that risk. They can ask you about how many people are there in your family, how big is your household, and that might not be a very PC question to ask, but the question may be framed as in, you know, how many seats do you have in your vehicle? So the question about how that drives pricing, well, the question is whether that those things are desirable or how you want to manage those dynamics when you have a rating system that allows other rating factors. So changes to premium relativities and rating factors are relevant for both publicly underwritten schemes and privately underwritten schemes, but in a privately underwritten scheme, obviously some of the issues will be more pronounced because you'll have insurers who, they'll have an incentive to avoid certain segments of the market where they think that the premium is inadequate. So currently different schemes around Australia already have sharing mechanisms in place, so I'm talking privately underwritten schemes of course, and examples are like the price and cap floor in Queensland and also the elastic gap system in New South Wales to limit the bonus malus that can be applied to policyholders. So the thing is though, in a first party scheme, the gap between what's good risks and poor risks, the gap between them is actually would be widened a little bit because you're including claims from the at fault driver. So what it means is that you may need sort of new solutions in terms of how to manage these market dynamics, and it may be things like doing a combination of capping premium relativities plus introducing risk pooling. So what do I mean by risk pooling? So there's a number of different types, and obviously this list is not exhaustive. There is lots of variations in between. First one is an assigned risk pool, and this is where all the eligible high-risk policyholders are allocated to an assigned pool, and that pool might be a publicly underwritten pool or some other vehicle. But the main thing is that because they're charged a rate that's lower than their true risk, then the other insurers other policyholders in the market have a responsibility for funding the deficit in that assigned risk pool. So such a mechanism like this, it overcomes the issue of affordability of premium for these high-risk categories. But then the other thing is it does little, though, to encourage competition, innovation, competitive pricing for these high-risk categories, because these risks are going to be charged one rate, they're out of the hands of the insurers, and the other thing is that the experience from these assigned risk pools has actually been quite poor in overseas markets and also past experience in Australia. Another option is claims equalisation, and this is similar to the system that's in private health insurance now, where the claims costs from high-risk categories are pulled together and shared in a certain way, in a predefined formula. So the advantage of the second option over the first option is that at least the insurers retain the customer relationship with those high-risk category policyholders, and also they retain the premium income, and it's not carved out of the market altogether. But then there's still issues about, you know, there is reduced incentives for insurers to manage those claims well because, again, the financial consequences of managing claims well is diluted because the cost of claims are shared with other insurers. Another thing is that under a claims equalisation system, well, in a private health insurance market, the claims settle quite quickly, whereas in a CTP market, the claims take many years to settle. So the claims equalisation process under a CTP scheme could take many years before it's actually resolved. The last option on the slide there is risk equalisation, and that is where where an insurer that writes a lot of high risk category business, they receive a fixed subsidy per risk, whereas insurers who write a lower volume of these high-risk categories have to pay a fixed subsidy per risk in which they're writing less in the market. So the good thing about this option is that it gives insurers greater incentives to, one, manage the claims well, because, again, the financial consequences is all on them. Two, they have an incentive to price these risks as efficiently as possible, because where they're able to select these risks or price these risks better than their competitors, again, they reap the benefit of that. And another thing is that with this such a mechanism, you can do it quite earlier on in the piece. It doesn't experience the delays that you might have under a claims equalisation system. So you can do the risk equalisation adjustment quite earlier on in the policy process. But obviously, in balancing so many things, in effecting these cross-subsidisation transactions, it is a little bit more complex to implement. So, in summary, I wanted to get back to one thing, which is there are a lot of things we haven't covered in our presentation today, like transition mechanisms and due to time constraints, but if you're interested in knowing more, then feel free to see any of us here during or after the conference. But in summary, there are social and policy advantages in moving to a first-party no-fault scheme, and that's shown by some of the recent investigations around Australia. There are many technical issues to be resolved, but we've raised some of these issues today, but we've also provided some options. Well, we've discussed some options about how some of those can be overcome. Now, a key challenge is that all these considerations are quite interlinked, so it requires a lot of thought in terms of, you know, how... it requires a lot of thought in terms of thinking through all the interaction and all the possible behaviours between all the stakeholders and mapping those out and deciding how, you know, how people might try to game the system or how the system can be taken advantage of. But mainly, given what we've covered here today, we think a first-party no-fault scheme is feasible in a private sector, and it just requires a new approach to manage some of those market dynamics. So hopefully we've provided some food for thought to assist future debate about the feasibility of first-party no-fault scheme. Thank you.
Okay, so that was the 5-minute bell. And so we do have some time for questions. And I can see some very knowledgeable CGP folk in the audience. So let's put Peter McCarthy to work. He's been sitting here doing nothing. Any questions? Up the back. Can you please speak into the microphone and identify yourself?
G'day, Len Bowen. As the presentation unfolded, the complexity of the underwriting gradually went off in my head. I'm curious about any maths you've done on modelling, in the sense of I have no idea the young hoods, the groups that traditionally are considered nearly underwritable, even in fault-based systems, depending on how you allocate the cost, I'm assuming that most of their costs relate to other vehicles. So it's, in some approaches, I'm assuming it's possible that the distribution where risk is would change absolutely off the chart. As, for example, if a young hoon crashed into a bus and the whole cost goes to the vehicle where people are inside, as occurs in, say, TAC, suddenly the risk of young hoons may be greatly reduced as an underwriting issue because much of their risk relates to who they hit, not themselves or the people in their vehicle. Have you got any information about some of the weird combinations you've discovered on considering this?
You are right, Len. It's complex. And there's quite a few moving parts. And I suppose I didn't quite get all of your question, but it is very obvious to us that the bad risks get a lot worse in a first-party scheme, first-party no-fault, and the better risks get better. So if you don't actually try and actually deal with the cross-subsidy issues, you're actually going to get some quite perverse market activity. there is... Like the under 25-year-olds, their claims experience will get worse. Be quite right. If they hit a tree or something, that's not an issue because it gets allocated to the insurer of the vehicle. But if they hit someone else, which occurs quite often, unfortunately, the cost, if it's not redistributed, will actually go to the not-at-fault insurer. Yeah. So you really have to find a way to actually deal with the cross-subsidies and the sharing of costs, the liability around the scheme.
And that was one of the things we sort of talked about before, where you can split up the sharing arrangements for at-fault components versus the not-at-fault components. And then obviously we've also talked about potentially different sharing mechanisms for different vehicle classes. So buses might be a special one where you might share them a little bit differently. Where, you know, there's a bus and a car, you might share them very differently to how you might share a bus and a car and a truck or something.
I've got two questions. One is that...
Wait.
They want to record the question.
One of the things that's always lost in the debate between no fault and common law is economic loss. And the fact that the truth is no fault schemes have to be based around an average weekly earnings idea, whereas common law is always full economic loss. And there's a total failure to actually address that to the community. And then related to that issue at the moment is the fact that the community seems to be much better insured in respect of some of these things through superannuation funds providing disability covers and salary continuance type products and things like that. But that tends to be favouring the white collar workforce rather than the blue collar workforce. To what extent did you really, you know, look at those sort of dynamics and how they might interface with a movement to no fault? And how might they be taken into account or not taken into account?
3 seconds if you
can't. No, we didn't.
Why not?
Didn't have time.
That sounds like a good topic for discussion over dinner tonight, perhaps, because there's a lot to that question. But we have unfortunately run out of time. Can you please put your hands together and thank Vivian, Mary and Peter?